Let him reverently welcome venerable men who visit him. Give them his own seat. Let him sit near them with joined hands. And when they leave, accompany them, walking behind them. So here is that even though he's educated, he is a graduate, he may be running his own school, he may be a respected man in the community, he may be a Kshatriya himself, but those who are respected persons, then he should welcome them and give them his own seat. So the seat is always considered a very special thing. Someone's seat in their house is always, that's their seat. No one sits in their seat. You know, that's one of the things that they tell, door-to-door salesmen. When they go into people's houses, never sit down first. See where they tell you to sit down. Because if you sit in their seat, then they're automatically going to be upset. You know? So if you let them arrange it, they'll sit in their seat, and then they'll tell you where you can sit. So sitting in someone's seat, that's considered a very, you know, it's because it's someone's house, so that's their place. That's their place of respect, where they like to do their work. So here he's saying, give them their his seat. So that means he's taking that they're, you know, more venerable than himself. You know, they're always respectable. So then that's always, because generally the seat is generally, you know, the most useful seat. You know, like that. So he gives them their place to sit. You know, let them sit near them with joined hands. Means near, so you can hear what they say. Render service. Do so many things. And, you know, joined hands means one respectful, and accompany them walking behind them when they leave. Because it said if you take seven steps with somebody as they're leaving, then it's you're considered companions or friends. You know, walking seven steps together, then that's considered your friends. That's why, like in the marriage ceremony, of three main rituals that actually make the marriage ceremony, one of them is taking seven steps together, because then they're considered friends, like that. The other two are making making vows and following the husband. The third is that they're friends. So that's the final of the three, because that's what will remain. So then walking behind them means his friend. If you just go to the, you know, walk up to the door, you just, you know, you're sitting there and say, okay, yeah, hi, I'll see you later, and then they walk out on their own. You know, it means it's informal or it's this and that, but it's not either intimate or it's not, formal, you know, or respectful. Respectful meaning, that's not disrespectful, but it's not the form of, you know, offering someone proper respect, you know. Being very attentive, like that. So you'd go up to the door, or even go beyond the door, depending on the situation, like that. You know, see them like that, accompany them, walking behind them for some time, or you know, at least you see like when Krishna would go off in the distance of the chariot, and they would watch until they're gone out of sight. So you know, it depends on the situation. You know what it is. Like if they go out the door and then there's around the little hall and then around the corner you don't see them, or like, you know, like in the stairs in our building. You can only see them so far, so generally you would attend up to that point. Either going up to your door and then just watching, or taking them out to the, you know, the building, or, you know, depending upon what it is, the formality or the relationship, it would mean that much farther you would go. So you can see is that... So it's coming back, you know, this thing of the. You'll see. Is remember the 10 items of. Where was that? Meditation, conclusions of ascetics. So we're missing some papers. You don't have a way to work on all the papers. So this isn't my papers.
You need the last pages?
Yeah.
58-59.
You like that, it's probably a nice thing. So the tenfold law is on 58. mentions this: contentment, forgiveness, self-control, abstention from unrighteously appropriating anything, obedience to the rules of purification, coercion of the organs, wisdom, knowledge of the Supreme Soul, truthfulness, abstention from anger, form the Tenfold Law. So those then get folded into nonviolence, truthfulness, not taking others, purity and control of the senses. Right. And then, so that's what you do. Then you have to respect those that you get knowledge from, those that you get culture from, and that, like we see the previous verse then was on the this point of follow the customs, you know, of those who are advanced. Oh, that's the next one here. Let him untired follow the conduct of virtuous men connected with his occupations, which has been fully declared in the revealed text and in the sacred tradition, Smriti, and is the root of the sacred law. So he should follow the conduct of virtuous men who are following their occupation as it is given in the scriptures. Like that. That's what one should do. Like that. So is that previous verse where it said the Veda, the Smriti, the conduct of virtuous men, and then your own adjustment with it. These are the four ways you decide on what is appropriate for yourself. So here again, those first three are mentioned. Follow the conduct of virtuous men who are following the scriptures that are based on the Veda. Right. So again, it comes back to that point. Through virtuous conduct he attains long life. Through virtuous conduct, desirable offspring. Through virtuous conduct, imperishable wealth. Virtuous conduct destroys the effect of inauspicious marks. That one may have, due to some improper behavior or something in previous life, then in this life one is born with symptoms that are not considered auspicious. So then by virtuous conduct, then that's removed. That's destroyed. So we can see is from here is that through proper conduct, then whatever one wants, that can be gained. People looking for wealth, long life, you know, good family relationships, whatever it may be, status in society, everything. But that's all done by proper behavior. So of course here, proper behavior means what's revealed in the sacred text and the tradition. And then it follows the conduct of virtuous men. So now for us, then those virtuous men are our acharyas and whoever they refer to. You know, they refer to them, so many scriptures that refer to, like Prahlad Maharaj, Dhruva Maharaj, or they may refer to, you know, other like Muchukunda and who is it? Kadandran King. It's one of the Alwars. About, I think he's the one about the lotus. May my mind become entangled in the lotus flower. Kulashekar. Yeah. So he's not in our line. He's Sri Vaishnav Acharya. But his conduct is such that we take example from it. So that's the point. It's what's good we take from anywhere. So he's one of the Lord's, you know, eternal associates. And so we always quote from him. Yeah. So we have our approach to this. So our smritis and our acharyas, then what they say, we follow that. Because depending on the virtuous men, they are trying to obtain to elevation. So someone who's not so sure or going for a lower elevation, then following basically any virtuous man will elevate you. Right? Because minimum they're going to try to be nice here, go to the heavenly planets. Right? But if you want to go to Vrindavan, then you follow those that are from there and conduct that they say is exemplary from others. Like that. Because certain principles are always there. Like sometimes in the example of surrender to guru and following of certain rules and things like that is sometimes more explicitly shown in the Vaikuntha Sampradayas, because rules are their thing. So that, or we see in the pastimes of Ramachandra, You know, because maryada, following the rules very nicely, the taste of following the rules perfectly, is the pastime. So then sometimes those examples are given because they're so prominent, like that. While ours will also have those strong points, but then they're more subtle and worked more into the pastime. You know, it's generally in a bigger pastime, like that. Because that the taste of the lila is what is important. Well, here it's the taste of the rule. So this rule being followed is the taste, that rule being followed. So therefore it stands out more. Does that make sense? Well, in ours we have the same examples, but sometimes because it's within a bigger pastime, and the whole idea is tasting the pastime, the lila, like that, because it's not on reverence. It's servitude is not the main flavor. Right? So then the main flavor is the first three rasas. So those will stand out more. Does that make sense? So even though we have all these things within our sampradaya, and you know also very, very subtle points of it, the very general, very strong principle of it, many times it will be referred to by our acharyas to other personalities. You know, just because it's the thing that they are known for. You know, it's like that devotee is known for that surrender to guru or surrender to the order or humility or like this. You know, so they'll be like that. Just like Lord Chaitanya, he taught different qualities through different devotees. Like Visvanatha Goswami taught humility. Like Ramananda Roy, control of the senses. Then Damodar Pandit, objective criticism. Okay. You know the other two? Tolerance. Okay. Four. Oh, maybe, yeah. So Sturgis. I think there were five. Okay. But whatever. So he teaches through that. But when you think of Sanatana Goswami, you don't necessarily think of humility. Because everything he does is within that, but it's because it's within the whole pastime. It's the flavor of it. It's not caught that that is the outstanding quality that Lord Chaitanya is teaching through him. Or Ramananda Rai, then, generally if we ask about Ramananda Rai, then we'll think of that conversation with Lord Chaitanya, the instruction. Or the instruction, that, you know, so for us, the instruction and these different things will be very prominent. These qualities. But you see in the Vaikuntha lines, then generally there, that quality, because it's a rule, it stands out so much, and then everybody respects that devotee for that. You know, it's just like you have. I'm not sure if it was Kuresh or someone, Ramanuja's disciple. He was facing Ranganath, you know, and taking darshan with folded hands, and Kuresh was standing on the side next to the door, facing Ramanuja with his back to the deity. You know? So then Ramanuja says, hey, you're not supposed to pay back to the deity, you know, like that. It says, I don't know him. You know him. I know you. So he means nothing to me. Like that. You mean something to me. So knowing you, then I've served you, you serve him. So you're my deity. Like that. So that's surrender to guru. So then he's known for, you know, like that. And that becomes very prominent. So it gets the point across, and it's very easy and clear to understand. You know, it's a very simple, short pastime that gets the point across, and it can always be understood and remembered and applied. But while in Lord Chaitanya, Sanatana Goswami, it's many times very elaborate and all that, because you're dealing now with beyond Vaikuntha in Vrindavan, where the subtleties of simultaneously conflicting flavors are going on all at once. So it's there, but then sometimes to get the point across, our acharyas will also mention, you know, so many personalities. Like that. Does that make sense? Like that. So whoever's outstanding in quality, then they're mentioned for that. So then we read this as that conduct of virtuous men here, because it's using virtuous. Virtuous here we would think, you know, moral upstanding and all that. It does mean that, but it just depends on what your definition of morality is. Morality is following the scriptures. You know, and then those who are following the scriptures, then it means being good, nice, this, that. But if it means pleasing God, then you always have to see, because there's so many levels in the scriptures. Sometimes a higher one will cut a lower one. So if the acharyas, then how they give, which ones are followed and which ones cut. You know, which ones deal with what's primary and secondary. Here. Yeah. Let him without tiring daily mutter the Veda at the proper time, for they declare that to be one's highest duty. All other observances are called secondary duties. Right, so here, Manu then makes the point that studying and reciting the Veda, that is the primary duty. Right? In other words, studying the Veda, teaching it to others, like that, and contemplating it oneself. This is the highest. Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam. So in that way, through the medium of this, it's said that that is the highest. Everything else is secondary. Right? Because Padasevanam, Archanam, Dasyam, Sakyamani. These are all secondary. You have that, that's primary. Everything else is in connection with that. Because how you surrender if you're not remembering, or you're not chanting, or you're not hearing? You know, how you serve, all your connection is through that. So here they made the point that Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu Smaranam is the highest. But that's how we would define it in the words we'd use. But here, because it's a general point, then, you know, the Smartas and the Karmakandis and that may not take to, if it's like Vishnu and all that, then they may not be inclined. Because then it's surrender and everything like that. And they want result, they want material gain and result and happiness. Or they want out of the material world, they want to be God. So then these things don't, so you say the same thing, but you use different words. That's why there's no, it says in the beginning, there's no contradiction between scriptures. They're both right. It's just you have to know how to take them back far enough to where they meet. Then you understand the common principle that they're based on. You know, like here, then we understand that that murmuring the Veda, you can only murmur it if you've studied it. Right? And that means there has to have been interaction with the teacher. And for a snataka, that means you're murmuring the Veda because you're teaching it. Right? You constantly chant the Veda because you're going over it and revising it with your students. Right? And then you contemplate what it means, you discuss the things, all these different things, the Veda. So that means you're hearing, you're chanting, and you're remembering. Does that make sense? So that's what's going on. But it's written in a way that anyone who is agreeing to follow Vedic culture, from the, you know, gross materialist, the fruit of worker, all the way up to the devotee, can follow it. But we understand it like that, just like this. Following the conduct of virtuous men. We know virtuous men mean our acharyas. And all those that they say are virtuous. Right? We don't have our own idea of virtue. You know, our own idea that's maybe separate from the Veda. Because then if it's our own idea, then it's modern. Right? Manu's definition of modern means non-Vedic. Right? One could say, no, it's a time and space, you know, that this is modern. You know, but at the same time it's not, because modern means what's happening now and what's temporary. Right? That's what it means. So if it's not Vedic, means it's only the person who's thinking of it, it means something to them. And when they're dead, it's gone. It changes. So it's temporary. So therefore, modern just means non-Vedic, that's all. That's the actual definition of modern. You know what I'm saying? Very simple. Otherwise, the modern man thinks highly of himself, so he tries to make himself seem like a unique point in time. But no. Whatever is going on today that's not Vedic or is one's own speculation, that's modern. Right? One misconstrues the Vedas, that's modern. Right? It's a very different way of looking at it. It kind of like doesn't make modern man special. You know what I'm saying? Because modern man likes to make himself special. But it makes them not special, because all it means is they just don't follow the Veda. So if someone's being modern, then they're just not following the Veda. Now we can preach in a modern context or modern environment. We may use their mediums in that, but we don't change our connection to the scripture or our conduct or our culture. You know, like Prabhupada used everything in Krishna's service, but he never changed his mood or anything. You know what I'm saying? mood of that it's all connected to the scripture and all connected back to Krishna. So to just say, oh, well, it doesn't matter, this is, you know, modern times, things are changing, we use everything, but we don't take on the mentality of those who use it. That's the point. Prabhupada used a dictating machine, but he didn't become a modern man to use it. Right? You know, to use a dictating machine, you don't have to have put on pants and a polo shirt. You know, that's the point. You know, it's just like, if you're doing something Vedic, then devotees will naturally put on dhotis and that. But if they're doing something they consider as just ordinary, as modern, they feel more comfortable putting on karmic clothes. Right? Because it goes together. But you could do the same work in your dhoti. You might say, no, it's not practical. It means, you know, you can look all over India. People are building roads, constructing and everything, and they're not wearing pants. A few of them are now. You go back 20 years, none of them were. And even today, hardly any of them are. And there's the women out there on the construction sites building roads and buildings wearing saris with their heads covered. Of course, it's a little easier to cover your head when you've got a bunch of bricks holding the cloth on. But you know. But the point is they're doing it. So that's the thing, is you don't have to do that. You can if you want, but you don't have to. So there should be no philosophy that you have to, or it's perfectly normal. No, you can do it. For those who are not devotees, they do like that. Those who are devotees who have accepted the culture, if, what's the need? It's so much more difficult to deal with. You know, you have to change, you have to this, you have to that. You know, it's just a matter of getting used to it, learning how to wear it. Right? You know, it's just like, some will say, oh, but it's so hard to wear, you know, the Indian clothes are always adjusting, always falling off. I see Western sewn-on clothes. It means they're always having to, you always have to pull them up because low riders, they always go a little lower than you want. You know, a few too many hairs stick out, you got to pull it back up. You know, the tight tank tops, you got to pull them up a little bit or pull them down a little bit. They always have to play with their hair, you always have to do this, you always have to do that. They're constantly playing with it. And that's sewn-on cloth that's skin tight, and they still have to play with it. So it's just a matter of what you're used to, then you don't mind playing with it. You know? You know? It's just like if you have pants, right? You're standing around, nothing to do, you have to stick your hands in the pocket. Right? You have to. Yeah. You know? Otherwise you look not cool. But you can stand around a dhoti and chudder and you never feel inspired to stick your hands in the pockets. You don't feel a lack, there's no pockets in my dhoti. Right, because there's things to do with your hands. You always have something to do with them. Because there's nothing to do with your hands, therefore, you know, you just put them in your pockets. Does that make sense? Mm. Yeah, so that's all. It's created by the medium of the thing. So the point is that Yukta Vairagya means that you use everything in Krishna's service, but in a way that's pleasing to Krishna within the culture. You know, like that. You know, so it's nice. Same time as if it's appropriate, then one may use other things. Like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, you know, he'd wear those fancy leather shoes and that long overcoat and all that. But that's kind of where it stopped. Oh, and he wore a cashmere sweater, cardigan. Like that. But he still wore his lungi and utariya. Like that. So he had this long coat below his knees and a few inches below that was his dhoti was sticking out. And then he had the socks and those shoes. Yeah, turban. Yeah, he had the turban on with that. So the thing is, we have a culture, and if we can probably wear those long coats. There's that famous pictures in L.A., yeah. You know, and then that had drawstrings on the hood, and it had peacock feathers sewn onto them, like that. And that one, it's on the BTG, the famous one where Prabhupada's sitting sideways with his finger raised in the Gyan Mudra. If you look carefully, he's wearing a poncho that has a hood, like that. I've seen it in Puru. Prabhu has in the museum. You know, a poncho, a square thing with a hole in the middle, a Mexican thing with a hood on it. I think it was wool or something, with saffron or something like that. It's a wool poncho. Prabhupada is wearing there.
Srila Maharaj keeps this tradition alive in Nivajrava, wearing this long coat.
Yeah, yeah. But he's using Indian cuts, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's for the situation one can look very, very proper. You know. One just has to know what's available. You know, like that. And then it works. So that's the point here, is that the conduct of virtuous men mean our acharyas. And revealed texts, the sacred tradition, means that are the texts that are of our line and the traditions of how they're followed. Does that make sense? So if one understands these things, then all the Vedic scriptures, then they're all saying the same thing as the Bhagavatam is saying. Just that it's more hidden. You know, maybe more wordy, more hidden, not as direct. But it's all there. That was Narad Muni's point to Vyasadeva. Is that you've written everything, but you haven't pointed out that Krishna is the goal of life. Devotion, pure unalloyed devotion to Krishna is the goal of life. Prema is what is there. That's not clear because of the language. Though for someone like Vyasadeva, he'll see everything's written in and it's gotten in and it's all done. You know, it's just like, you know, it's like the, how you say? Italians make a pasta, you know, with spinach and the pumpkin. See these different colored pastas? If it's green color, it means it's made with spinach. If it's orange, it's made with pumpkin. Like that. So many times kids don't like to eat vegetables. But they love pasta, so they stick it in the pasta. So that's what Vyasadeva's done. So he's stuck everything into the Vedic literatures so that whatever has to be done is done. But because it's not known, therefore, then the person doesn't make that commitment. He doesn't become Vyavasayatmika Bhuti. He doesn't become one-pointed. Like the kid just sees it's pasta, he doesn't know it's vegetables held together by pasta. You know, like that. So he doesn't catch that. So because of that, then they won't come to the point of actually appreciating vegetables. They'll appreciate pasta. So that's Narad Muni's point, is that they'll appreciate the pious activities or the fruit of results, the enjoyment that's gained from that, all those things. That they'll appreciate. But they won't actually appreciate why do you have long life, why do you get good offspring and wealth and all, because you're pleasing God. So then if you're directly pleasing God, you don't worry about these things. Those things are there, not there, what does it matter? Because you go back to Godhead, then, you know, you can't get a longer life than eternity, you know, like that. Does that make some sense? So it's just understanding how to convert these things. But, yeah, so everything is there in the other, but one has to know what's there. So that's why the Vedic literatures are broken into 14 topics. So that you can actually identify what is there. Otherwise the tendency is just, like if you ask devotees about culture, you know, or about Bhagavatam, what is it? They'll just say it's just philosophy. The idea that it's culture that we'd apply in our lives, no, it doesn't work. Oh, he's a king, he wears a crown, I don't wear crowns, so therefore, you know, Yudhishthira's management and his tolerance of, you know, adversity and kindness, and don't apply to my life because I don't wear a crown and sword. You know, it's that simplistic. You know, it doesn't apply to me. That's 5,000 years ago. Why would it apply now? You know, you understand? So that's what happens, is they don't see it because they don't know that that's what it is. They don't know that, okay, here is, you know, Arthashastra or Dhanurved or Dharmashastra. Or Niti Shastra, you know, your morality. It's not known. Bhagavatam, so many verses are Niti Shastra. You know, whenever it's talking like, you know, that, you know, the foolish person talks about fools, that's Niti. Niti always opens with fools. The first verses are always on fools. Because first, if you don't identify a fool, And then avoid it, you can't be moral. You know, because fools aren't moral. Because morality means you distinguish between good and bad. A fool means he can't distinguish. So the first point in Niti Shastra is identify what is a fool. Like that. So some Nitis give more, some give less. You know, Chanakya and others, and they'll give like, I think, 5, 6, 7 varieties of fools. But like when Vidura, you know, who's Yamaraj, is speaking to Dhritarashtra in Vidura Niti during the battle, when Dhritarashtra asks him about good conduct, and that he lists 17 kinds of fools. You know, and most likely Dhritarashtra falls into one of those categories. Definitely his son does. But. No, that's Mahabharata. Like that. Vidura Niti's there. You'll get some. You'll get in these different places that. You know, like Bhishma tells how to manage the kingdom and some different things. And so Bhagavatam, you'll find all the different points, but it's the essence of it. So if you know the Shastra, then you see, oh, this is the essence. You know, like we know our scriptures, so then therefore we can see, okay, this is a central verse. Oh, that's a central. This is what, this means this, that means that. You know, like the verse, okay, like that means just, you know, very outstanding. Is that the wife still respects a husband who doesn't follow anything, do anything, this, that, because of the principle of Aslishiva Padre Kampi Nashtamam. Like that. Because she wants to be successful in this sphere. So therefore, she maintains that virtue in this sphere. So therefore, all of her whatever benefits she'll get in this sphere is gotten. Right? Means even he goes to hell, she'll go to the heavenly planets. In fact, she might even take him with her because of her virtue. And in the spiritual world, then there you have Krishna. And no matter what his mood is, if that surrender to Krishna is there, then Krishna is pleased. So then all benefit is there, because Radharani is pleased. You only see some difference if you want to cross. Right? You want to stay in the material world, then okay, then definitely, then that rule applies, because it's just a reflection. Right? That's the highest thing there. You know, that's considered the highest, like elevating surrender. Here it's considered like a low end. It means it's surrender, but it's surrendering in adversity. Well, there it's not considered adversity. Though it is adversity, but it's not considered. It's a reflection. But because you're trying to cross the Viraja, then the wife may or may not stay with such a husband. If it's favorable for a devotional service, she'll stay with him. She can go on with the service, do everything like this and that. She has all of her facilities. She's protected. Then what does it matter? You know, the guy's a louse. That's his problem. You know, and she's a devotee. Okay, so then, you know, he'll be busy doing other things. Then she'll have time for her sadhana and everything like that. But if it's unfavorable, then she can leave it. Because the real morality is surrender to Krishna. So no matter what Krishna does, you still surrender to him. So he's giving you a bozo husband, but you still surrender to Krishna. Like that. So that principle remains. Is that, and it still may have a higher one cuts a lower one. It's the same principle. You know, it's just like rasa. You have the senses, you have the emotions, and you have transcendental. So you can give up sensual for emotional, or emotional for spiritual. But not vice versa. You can't give up emotional for sensual. Everyone will say that's self-centered. Or give up spiritual for emotional. Everyone will say that's maya. You know, sentimental. But the other way, that's always considered glorious. You know, that's, how you say, selfless service. You know, everybody will think that that's good. Like that. Yes, ma'am. Different fools. I'm not. We haven't finished the work on that because after Manu, then that's the next work is on Niti and Arthashastra because it's all one group of knowledge, what we call civics, like that. It's just all the social, you know, the social form and interaction and customs and all that. So that's one of the main branches of. I think it's one of 8 topics. that the academy teaches. So one branch is civics, like that. Basically, I think Chanakya makes the point, the fool is someone who you give him good advice, he can't follow it. That's like the essence. So that means Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana. Because they'll only make trouble. Like that. But I think there's, you know, varieties within it.
You know. I remember in Mahabharata, there is some place where there is a conversation between Vidura and Dhritarashtra, and after listening all of those instructions, Dhritarashtra made such a conclusion. He says, like, oh, I agree with you, all your instructions are very value, have big value, but unfortunately I cannot accept them. Just like, they're just like sparks, like lightnings in the sky or something.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it like that? Why is Dhritarashtra couldn't accept?
Because of his attachment.
No.
He's so attached to his son that he knows it's right. Dhritarashtra's point is he's very educated. You know, many times we take him as just to be quite ordinary. He's very educated. Mm-hmm. Like that. He's known as a Rajarshi. Mm-hmm. Because he knows the scriptures and this and that. You never hear of any problem in his kingdom or anybody revolting, rebelling, or people being dissatisfied or anything like that. Only when they go against the Pandavas, then you hear of such things. But otherwise, he's very educated. You know, I mean, he's Vyasadeva's son, so he can't be such a bozo. So then, but the point is because of his attachment, he cannot follow it. So his ideal would be if Duryodhana would listen to good advice and follow it, because then both his attachment and the law would be consistent.
Mm-hmm.
But of the two, the law and his attachment is the primary. So he always tries to bring his attachment in line with the scriptures. But if it's not, the attachment is primary. You know, so that just puts it into, you know, to sakam, like that. Nishkam means the rule is primary and our attachments fit into that. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You understand? One is you start with the rule, then I have these attachments, how to fit them in, how to engage them in Krishna's service, and how to dovetail them. The other one is I have these attachments, now let's see if I can use them in Krishna's service. If I can, nice, if I can't, then, you know, what to do. That's the difference in the approach.
Mm-hmm.
So his is just a very extreme case of this sakam, that he knows Krishna's God, he knows all these, he knows everything, but that's why it's very hard to tell what he's saying, because Vidura will speak, he agrees with him. Bhishma speaks, Kripa speaks, he agrees with them all. And then at the same time as then when he finds Duryodhana doesn't agree with them, then he says, I was just saying that so they wouldn't understand my mood, this and that. Because he does agree with them scripturally, but he can't accept it if his son doesn't accept it. If his son accepts it, then he's happy. You know, he'll follow all the rules, but he's just got a bad son. So he's got so much attachment that he kept the bad son. He was told by everyone, get rid of this son. You know, because he's going to destroy everything. Because based on that principle, you can give up, you can sacrifice a family member to save a whole family. You know, so here family meant a whole dynasty, you know, the whole Ku dynasty, like that. So they were told, get rid of this one son to save the whole dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
But he was so attached, he couldn't. You know, because the point is someone who's blind, then they are only dependent. There's no such thing as independence.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? The person who can see has independence. He can move around on his own. There's nothing he can do on his own. He has to have servants take him around, show him everything, do everything for him. So that's why a blind person, you know, can't become the king. Because he's dependent. He's not independent. A king must be independent.
Mm-hmm.
He's dependent. The only reason he's king is because Bhishma's dead. Bhishma wasn't there, there's no question Dhritarashtra would be king. No question. So that's the principle. Because the sense is powerful, so focus. You see, it's a difficulty. This means your karma is going to be distracted because he has so many desires. Therefore, you know, the Manoratha mentions that they have so many desires, so they're not vyavasayatmika. They're not focused. So they're always absorbed, but it's just moving from one to the next, to the next, to the next. He's got, let's say, 100 desires, and they just kind of like take turns, so he's always in Maya. You know, so it's no big deal, he's in Maya, and it's just this platform he functions from. He doesn't know, not in Maya. But you have a intelligent person, a trained person, then they cut out all these desires. So then they can focus. So then they advance very quickly and become very mature. But if one of the senses distracts the intelligence, the focus on that sense is vyavasayatmika. So that's why so quickly they can go into that so deeply. But at the same time is, if they can catch that it's wrong, by their own understanding, then they get out immediately. That's why these whole things of morality for Brahmins like this doesn't apply. You know, the Shudra, he is attached to the senses, so if he gets off into sense gratification, there's a good chance he's happy there. Or he may know it's bad, but how will he get out? Because he doesn't have the focus to get out. But the Brahmin has been out. So in other words, those who have been falling and have been out, if they get distracted, it's just a matter of refocusing again on the proper path, and then they're immediately out. So then there's no need of prayaschitta and all that for them. Like that. Or the prayaschitta is very mild. You know, it's just like studying scripture or pilgrimages or things like that that are spiritually uplifting, because for them, that's what makes them, keeps them out. The Brahmin performs his brahminical duties. He stays out. You know, because his duty is contemplation. He studies the scriptures, he contemplates the scriptures, he teaches the scriptures. So therefore, that contemplation of what's right and wrong, what should be done, what should not be done, is his field. So contemplation. So if he's performing his duties, then he will contemplate. You know? Or if he goes out like on pilgrimage or does things like this that are spiritual, then he'll contemplate more. So that's why then for Brahmins you'll see it's different. So some may say, oh, this is unbalanced, it favors the Brahmins. No, it's just because of their nature. Their senses going off are different than the Shudra's senses going off. It's a difference. And that's why you don't have punishments for them. Like that, or the punishments are austerity. You never take the things. You never. There's never corporal punishment. There's no death penalty. There's, you know, these things are there. That's why it was that whole thing with Ashwatthama. You could say he's not acting as a Brahmin, therefore he deserves to be killed. But the point was, he was acting as a Brahmin. If he never had been, then you can say, yes, he's a pseudo-Brahmin, so he never was, so therefore he'd be dealt with as he actually is. But because he was as a Brahmin and a focused and advanced Brahmin, and the son of the teacher, so therefore then they have to punish him, but at the same time, it can't be corporal punishment. Or it can't be capital punishment. You know, they can't take his goods, they can't, because then you're stealing from a Brahmin. You know, so there's these things because he was a Brahmin. So that distinction always has to be made. You know, the king doesn't make these distinctions and he'll fail. he just judges everyone the same, he'll fail, guaranteed. Because otherwise, one may say is, no, that's normal, but it's not normal. Even your, you know, sophisticated modern courts don't work like that. Because there's only so many rules. What is it? Manu gives 18 laws. There's not more laws than that. Right? There's details of those laws, but there's not more laws than that. Right? You know, adultery, robbery, thievery. You know, it already distinguishes. It means if the person is not there, it's thievery. If the person is there and you use violence against the person, that's robbery. You know, or just like you take, if you're gambling, yeah, means if you gamble on something inanimate, then it's called betting. Right? No, it's gambling. And if it's on something animate, then it's betting. Like you bet on horses. Right? You gamble with cards. You know? Does that make sense? Like that. So it's already broken it all down. Now, the thing is so the rule's there, so it's very clear. But there's so many different applications of it, time, place, and circumstance. So there's finer and finer points, and this precedent, that precedent, and that. So therefore, there's a whole wall full of books that are explaining something that could most likely be put in, you know, a few hundred pages in one book. Like that. So even there, they make distinction. You know, what's the mentality, the responsibility, the this, the that, you know. Because in some things, then it's heavier on Brahmins. Like fines. Certain fines are heavier. Like that. So it just depends on the situation. If it's something like just a normal thing, like stealing or this or that, then you have to see, because even the Brahmins aren't dealt with in that way. You know, in a bad way. Adverse. Because there may be a need, because they're poor. So sometimes they get so poor, or this or that. Sometimes they just get too bent out of shape, and they just take something. But then, if they do take, they're only supposed to take from bad people, people that never use their wealth for any sacrifice or any good work. If they steal from them, then both of them will be elevated, because now that impious man's money has been used for pious work. Because this is for Brahmins who actually are using it in Brahminical activity. Not that he steals the money and then goes to the Riviera. Steals the money and does a sacrifice. Like that. Or he feeds himself or his family because they're going to die of starvation or stuff like that. You know. So, then one would consider these things. But something like adultery, where it's going to create mixed caste, that then they're very heavy with the Brahmins. Because the Brahmins can create the worst Varna Shankara. Right? Shudra can only make a small Varna. It means a Shudra can cohabitate with an outcast. Right? And create another outcast. But it's only gonna adjust it a little bit. You know? But if a Brahmin then cohabitates with a Shudra, an outcast, then you start getting really wild stuff. Or the opposite means that Shudras approach Brahmins. Shudra man approaches a Brahmin woman. Then that creates a chandala. So then that's very heavily dealt with. But if you approach the Vaishya, it wouldn't be so bad. Kshatriya worse than that, but Brahmin. And so it just depends upon, you know, the situation.
Those examples you gave, they're not mentioned, or they're not put in the category of apadharma, or duties in distress. Apadharma.
Apadharma?
Yeah.
Meaning like a Brahmin approaching a Shudra.
You gave a few examples like stealing from bad people. Or
yeah, it's in times of distress. Yes. But the point is the law deals with that. My point is the law takes into consideration time, place, and circumstance. Mm-hmm. That's the point, because the point, original point was, is you can't just have a rule and judge everybody by it. Mm-hmm. You've got the new devotee, he does something wrong, he gets the same treatment as the person who was the temple president. It doesn't work like that. No judicial system in the world will function like that. It doesn't mean that there's not some punishment or something, but that punishment just mean, you know, banishment or some other thing like that. It may not be severe as far as the way of fines or other things like that, you know, any physical injury or anything like that. But it, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Because of their focus.
But from a spiritual point of view, one who is more elevated, so if he can makes mistakes, so he gets more severe reaction than just, you know, new fight, let's say.
Yeah, but they can move in and out of it more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
They may go down fast, but they'll go up fast because they're at that level. If you've advanced in devotional service to 60%
mm-hmm.
and you get distracted, then as soon as you figure out that this is wrong, you're right back at 60%. Well, the new devotee, he's at 5%. He does something wrong, he falls down to, you know, less than 5, and then when he gets it together, he goes back to 5. So you can't say they're the same. And because of his 60% of realization, therefore he can understand and get out of it easier than the one who is, though he may have seemingly fallen lower. But the point is it means it's only so low you can get, you know. Like that. Well, there are extreme cases. Jagat Madai was pretty good at getting as low as you can get. The point is that that may appear as more fallen just because of the contrast. You know, it's just like now it's outside, it's somewhat cool compared to other days. You know, but we don't say it's cool. But if this temperature that it is outside was in a room and you were outside in the sun and walked into a room that had this same coolness, you'd go, wow, this is cool. You understand? So the contrast makes it more stand out more. So if someone is very advanced and they fall from that position, it looks like it's more abominable. But the stuff that they're doing may be the same or less than someone else. But because of the contrast, it looks worse.
So that's why one has to be very careful to judge such people.
That's the point. If you're in a position to judge, then you judge. Means you take, because to judge means you take the responsibility. A wrong judgment will fall on you. Like that. You know, it's just to let someone who's guilty go and to someone who's innocent to make guilty, both of them are very, very heavy. If brought up, Manu brings it up again and again. At least, I think, 2 or 3 times he mentions it. You know, that exact point. Because that's the thing, that justice has to be done. So, therefore, unless you're going to take responsibility for it, then it's there. But responsibility means you stand by it. So when a decision is made and then others question it, then you don't just start, well, no, but, you know, I mean, you don't start that. You say, yes, we made a decision based on this. And if it's wrong, then okay, it's wrong. We'll correct it. Because the king is mentioned. If any of his servants, in performing their duties of judgments, you know, judicial work, made any mistakes, then he's to set it correct. Right? But if what they've done is not a mistake, he's not to change it. You know, if what they've done is according to Scripture, it's proper, then he's not to change it. But if they've done something that's against the Scripture, then he has to change it. So that means that he's responsible. So even though the other judges did it, he didn't, well, they did the judging. No, he's responsible. Because otherwise, a bad decision, then quarter will go on the sin. Will, it means If a judgment is made badly, it means if a guilty person is set free, only one quarter of the sin will fall on the sinful person.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And, you know, it'll only one quarter will fall on him. One quarter will go on the judges, one quarter on the witnesses, and I think one quarter on the king. But if the king then judges and punishes correctly, then 100% falls on the criminal. nothing falls on anybody else. That's why this thing of judging others is a serious thing. You judge and you make a thing, then if you're not right, you share. You'll share in as much of the reaction as it will be with the thing. So there's four people involved. If witnesses are involved, the witnesses are there. If there's no witnesses, then it'll be divided up by three. If you are the authority, you don't have anyone above you, then it falls on two. You get 50-50. The point is it's shared if it's wrong. So that's why it's said only person who is educated can be a judge. It's not enough that you have emotion and feelings. It's not enough. Because then, you know, it just reverses. You have such strong feelings against that person, then in your next life you'll be the one that does that nonsense. Because when you criticize somebody, then you take on the sin of their activity. You say someone's a non-this, that, this. If you're criticizing that activity, like you see, Prabhupada doesn't attack the person, he attacks the activity. That you can do. This is nonsense, that someone doing this or that position and all that. But it's never the person. As long as it's just the activity, then it's a matter, it's instructive. Because you yourself contemplate or are convinced, others you talk to become convinced or, you know, educated and everything like that. But if you criticize the person, then you take the sin. You share in that sin. That's why you see the person who's always criticizing others for a particular quality, with time, starts doing that activity. Because they keep taking on the sin of that activity till it accumulates to the point where now they start to do it themselves. That's how it works. Because you just see, it's a common thing that the person who's criticizing the most after a while is doing that thing. Because it's just, it means the reaction for it, it's just part of it's given to you. It's just the modes of nature arrange it that way.
Because it's not
actually done in a progressive way. Progressive means it's instructive, it's uplifting to everybody. The person themselves gets instructed, the others around who may be influenced get instructed, anyone involved or bystanding will get instructed. Person who's giving the instruction, you know, then they by speaking it, they contemplate it, they become more fixed in it. So that's progressive, so that's good. But if it's just criticizing and then trying to, in other words, one takes that morality has a meaning on its own. Morality has no meaning except for its connection to Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. And its only purpose, therefore, is Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra to please God. Right? And since God wrote the scriptures, therefore then, following that, then that's pleasing to God. So you see, the directly that you understand it is, so you try to do it in such a way that He is pleased. Or, you don't understand, and then at least it's indirect that you follow the scriptures. Right? If it's direct, it's called bhakti. If it's indirect, it's called piety. Right? Like that. Does that make some sense? So therefore then, because you consider that it has meaning on its own, but that's not the purpose. Morality's purpose is to keep you from becoming addicted to sense gratification and demoniac mentalities that keep you in the material world. In other words, addiction to control and enjoyment, that's what keeps us in the material world. So you see, as all these pious activities, they get rid of that. They start to break down that foundation of controlling and enjoying, because you're not in control. You're not the enjoyer. Okay, you have a little bit of control, you have a little bit of enjoyment, but according to the scriptures, this is your quota of controlling and enjoying. You take more than that, then you'll get reaction. You know, so you're trying to take the desire for unlimited control and enjoyment and reduce it to as minimal as possible. Like that. Does that make some sense? So that's what's going on in that process. So all these restrictions are only for the purpose of spiritual elevation. But that they have meaning on their own, and that they have lasting effect. You know, to say that once a devotee does something, then that's it. You know, he's like, you know, tainted forever. That means you don't have faith in the devotional process. The devotional process can correct anything. It's more powerful than any, because it's light. Right? Maya's nescience, darkness. Krishna's light. So with his light, there is no darkness. So the point is increase Krishna, then Maya will naturally decrease. Not that you cut them out of Krishna, and then somehow or another now, then you're going to give some system of prayaschitta. But the point is unless you're God, you don't know what is prayaschitta. Only God knows how to correct the mentality. Like that. Because he created the modes of nature. So he knows that when the mentality is in this modes, you need this modes to balance, to counteract it. And even then, it'll counteract the sin and the mentality even, but it won't get rid of the desire. That you have to do yourself.
So when one sees, usually if one is not mature enough, he can see some faults in some behavior of, you know, those who is going to be, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And just because he understands, oh, that's wrong, so he wants to say that's wrong, to show this, but on the more advanced level, one also think about how to make people that person understand how to deal with it, how to make, you know, advancement.
Mm-hmm.
And, mm-hmm. So it's like quote a good teacher, like, also because sometimes person just not on the such level that he can, you know, practically he can apply those instructions. So in those situations, one also takes responsibility. If instruction, good instruction is given in wrong time or in person, you know, that person is not ready to accept it. So it means an instructor is, you know, he accepts some kind of reaction for that.
It means it may be coming from a different reaction. Mm. And that's why it said you don't disturb the mind state. So that's why in the educational system, the Vedic educational system, you only take those who want to learn. So then your corrections, they accept because they want to be corrected. But those who aren't interested in being corrected are not taken on as students. You know, because the teacher shouldn't be instructing someone who doesn't want to hear. And he must do it in the gentlest way possible. So you can only be gentle with those who want to know, because they're humble, they're submissive. Right? Those who are rebellious, then the king takes care of them. The king knows how to deal with those who are rebellious. Does that make sense? That's why regulation is the whole point, is that when you have an attachment, you regulate it, then immediately it loses its taste, you know, because then it becomes a regular function. It's like a duty. Anything that's a duty, you don't like to do, you know. So if your sense gratification is a duty, then it kind of loses something like that. Because then you're looking at it with knowledge, you know, rather than just passion, a desire, like that. So then, you know, so there's like, you can't smoke the cigarette, so it has some interest there, and the taste and that. But there's no, you can smoke them, but you just have to smoke this many a day, or only at these times. So it's kind of like, you know, it's okay. You know, so what is it?
And then there is one shlok in third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, it said that sometimes a pious person, by some knowledge, goes to the hell, or a simple person goes to the heaven. So it means there are some kind of...
means they've done. The sinful person did one good thing. Mm-hmm. So for that, he'll be able to go to heaven. It doesn't mean he won't go to hell for those other things. It's just making the point is that the moralist attitude is someone who's bad is all bad, 100%. They couldn't do anything good. And the good person is all good, can't do anything bad. Because he's good, nothing will happen. And even if he does something bad, nothing wrong will happen to him. No, he'll go to hell for what he's done wrong. And the impious person, for whatever he's done right, will go to the heavenly planets, even though he may. So it may be the one spends 90%, you know, of his reaction in hell and 10% in the heavenly planets. The other one 10% in hell and 90% in the heavenly planets. But point is the thing is there. Because the tendency is to take everything in black and white. That's how you can tell maturity. Is it black and white or are there shades? And in those shades of gray, do you have a plan how to get them there? But the process may be different, but there is a process. You know, it's just like, okay, the person doesn't have that submission, so he doesn't go to the Gurukul. Okay, but he learns in the family, he learns in the guild, he learns in a... So everybody has a place in some way that they can be trained. Because it's not that they're a bad person, it's just that they can't handle the regulation of the senses. Like that, you know, and regulation of the, you know, all just this, their whole lifestyle, like that. They want a little bit, either more freedom or more in sense gratification, or more in emotion, like that. So then they don't fit into the school, but they fit into their home, they fit into the community, they fit into the guilds, like that. So they have a way that they're going to be elevated. Everybody gets elevated, you know, just like in the Vedic tradition, even the outcasts, the chandalas, the sapachas, the antavasains, like this, are the lowest end of the outcasts. But they're also, they have their place in the Vedic culture. It means like you have criminals have to be punished. Right? So they're punished by these people. Right? Because for them it's no big deal. They're probably hunters or sat, so it's not a big deal for them. The same time as then even they themselves who are rough and violent in their activities, then, you know, because it's a formalized thing of capital punishment or corporal punishment, therefore then they themselves then start to consider the evilness of violence. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? At the same time, they're benefited because it means, let's say there's capital punishment for somebody, then all his effects, you know, his furniture, all this, they go to that person who did the execution. Mm-hmm. Like that. So therefore then all these people are taken care of by that. Mm-hmm. You know. And same time as then you have, let's say you have family, someone's alone, they die, there's no relatives to cremate them or do anything like that. So then these people are brought to take them and take care. You know, at the same time as then their effects go to them. Mm-hmm. You know, or it goes to the government, they'll get part of them. If there's no inheritance, then you know, it goes to the government. Yes. Yeah, it means Yamadutas are forefathers who went to Pitri Loka, didn't have a descendant to perform the shraddhas to keep them, you know, taken care of. Because it's by the yearly shraddha, then your food and everything for the full year is then arranged. So if nobody performs the shraddha, then you don't get food, don't get all these things. You're in Pitri Loka, but you're starving, you know. So then after they've been in that condition for long enough, and that it's seen that no one's going to take care of them, you know, there isn't going to be anyone to take care of, and they've already gotten strange enough, then they're engaged by Yamaraj as Yamadutas. And then they're given the right to take a portion of others' shraddhas. So that way they can maintain themselves. You know? So they were probably a very nice-looking forefather, but then from, you know, not having food and other facilities for so long, and they themselves being so pious that they got there, and now seeing their family members being impious and not, that creates a lot of anxiety. So that with time will start to create those strange Yamaduta features. Right? Because, you know what I'm saying? Like...